This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The first front of the war on terrorism opened in Afghanistan just weeks after September the 11th. U.S. and Afghan forces routed the Taliban and its al-Qaeda allies. In the nearly 2.5 years since, there's been some progress. A new government, a constitution, the beginnings of an army, some reconstruction, and nationwide elections are scheduled for September. There is also deep concern that the situation could spin out of control. The Taliban and al-Qaeda remain active in parts of the country. The central government has little control outside the capital, and drug lords grow rich from the wide-scale cultivation of the opium poppy. There are also questions about international and especially American resolve. In a few minutes, we'll hear from analysts about what's working and what isn't. If you have questions about life there today, American policy, and the prospects for progress, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN, at npr.org. Joining us now is NPR's Renee Montagne. She's on a satellite telephone from Kabul in Afghanistan. Renee, thanks very much for staying up so late.
Oh, you're welcome, Neil. My pleasure.
You're there to report on preparations for the elections in September. What outstanding elements need to be in place for credible elections to take place?
Well, I think the talk here really is there's one single element that has to be in place, and that's security. The country is bristling with guns. The number that gets used commonly is 100,000 a militia under the command of warlords, not the central government, who are all well armed. And there's something between 8,000 and 9,000 soldiers in the National Army and a few thousand National Police. So that's really actually the big thing. I mean, there are very many technical things that the reason that the elections were originally scheduled for June and have been postponed till September are also technical, which is to say that, you know, in a vast country that hasn't even had a census, it's very rural, very small villages, you know, cities even don't have paved roads except the very biggest, like Kabul. There's just very big technical issues involved in trying to sort of set up registration booths and get people registered and also, you know, get them, you know, to vote. So, but security is the word around here.
Well, are people excited about the prospect of an election? Are they flocking to register to vote?
Well, they've been flocking. Might not be the word. It's been very slow going. They started registration in all the main cities in December, and the numbers were actually very disappointing. But in the last month, and certainly since the time we've been here, the last couple of 3 weeks, people have been coming to registration sites in the big cities. I mean, the numbers. The national figure is something like 18% of the population has now been registered. But one thing that, you know, that keeps being thrown out there is if that's sort of a bad number. But the fact of the matter is the registration sites have not been set up in the rural areas, which is 80% of the population. That'll happen the 1st of May, and the UN is talking about 4,200 sites. I mean, compared to, I think, about under 100 now in all the big cities. So the notion is that you know, more people are yet to be registered. You know, I ask if people are excited. I just have to say it's astonishing, and I keep looking for other people out there, but people are touchingly excited about registering the vote. The people that we've talked to, I was in a small village today where they haven't set up registration sites, and people are looking forward to the moment when they bring the registration sites to in that village. It's going to be the schools and the mosques, so that they can go in. What people keep saying is it's almost, you think they're saying it for our benefit, but they're actually not. You just couldn't get this sort of response. Things like, to be an Afghan for the nation, we really have to vote. This is our chance to vote. We've never voted before. It's our duty to vote. Every good citizen has to vote. So, I mean, you know, I'm talking on the ground. There's a lot of excitement.
What do they say they want as a result from this election?
Well, nobody talks about candidates, and believe me, I've asked each time. It's like, who, you know, nobody's running. I mean, President Karzai, Hamid Karzai, is obviously a candidate for the presidency, but, you know, they haven't registered people to vote, and there aren't real parties, and there's a suspicion of parties here because the parties have been fundamentalist Islamic parties. Before that, it was the Communist Party. People aren't too fascinated with the idea of parties, but when you put about, you know, candidates to them, a lot of people like Karzai, actually. They They like him. I mean, they respect him as a human being. A lot of people say they haven't made up their mind, which is sort of the honorable position, like, tell me who the candidates are and what their positions are, and I'll tell you who I'll vote for. But what they expect, when it really comes back to that, and that's usually what people sort of fall back on, is they want a government that will be efficient, that will be intelligent and sort of smart. They seem to want what anybody would want, I guess, which is a government filled with people who sort of know what they're doing. The thing that they don't want, and the people who speak out and are, I wouldn't say cynical, but who have a little more texture to this, and that could be anybody. I'm not talking about, specifically, professors. I mean, we went kite flying the other day and sort of polled people at this hilltop at Kabul that on Fridays, which is the Sunday here, is where everybody sort of gathers. And, they were a little bit like sophisticated because Kabulis are very sophisticated people. People will say to you, the one thing we don't want is to have this country run by warlords. The one thing we don't want and we're tired of is to be, mm-hmm. the place to be run by warlords. Funny enough, people don't too much talk about the Taliban. I mean, in this area, I know in the southeast, which I haven't been, Taliban are an issue. That's always obviously a stronghold for them. And in the very rural areas of the south, but in most other places, the Taliban, as it were, have been vanquished. It's a bad memory.
Renee Montaigne, again, thank you so much for staying up late with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
NPR's Renee Montaigne with us by satellite telephone from Kabul, Afghanistan, where she's reporting on preparations for the elections there, which are now scheduled for September. Joining us now here in Studio 3A is Seymour Hersh, a correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. His most recent piece from the April 12th edition is called The Other War, Why Bush's Afghanistan Problem Won't Go Away. And nice to have you back on the program.
Glad to be here.
It's interesting. Renee was just talking about the fondness that many people have for Hamid Karzai, the president. You and your story in The New Yorker with a sort of devastating analysis. Everybody likes Hamid Karzai.
Yes. This was told to me by actually one of the people involved in registering voters, not in Kabul. And Karzai, who was... I guess you can best describe the president as really nothing more than the mayor of Kabul. And I don't dispute anything your correspondent said. I'm sure everything she said is accurate. But Kabul is only one small part of the country. And it's pretty much wild Indians elsewhere in terms of security, in terms of Taliban presence. But in any case, one UN official told me that when he goes around the rural areas talking to people about getting ready to vote or register, one common phrase, a refrain, and he's paraphrasing, he's summarizing a lot of stuff. He said, but they say to me, this guy Karzai is a very nice guy. He doesn't sell drugs. He doesn't kill people. He doesn't commit crimes. What kind of man is that to lead Afghanistan? And his point being that it's apocryphal. He said what he said, and his point being that this is a very, very tough country. And some guy that's been established by the United States, lived in exile, you can almost see the analogy to the governing council we have in Iraq, all of whom lived in London, mm-hmm. or, Seville Road tailors coming back after the war. Some guy who lived abroad and comes in, imposed by the United States, while he may have, and he is well-spoken, and he's certainly bright, and although he's not personally corrupt, as far as we can tell, there's a tremendous amount of corruption around him. And you have a government that basically is run by warlords. Many of the people in Karzai's own cabinet are warlords themselves, control great areas, are involved directly in the drug business, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's always what makes Afghanistan so interesting and so hard to think about invading and overcoming is the great diversity.
One of the things, obviously, earlier in the program, we were focused on the testimony before the 9/11 Commission, a lot of that energized by Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief at the White House. One of his principal arguments in his book and not so much in his testimony, because I focused before 9/11, was that the Bush administration's focus on Iraq has distracted from the war in Afghanistan. He told you much the same thing.
Yes, I think one of the more important points he made in his book, and as you say, less so on television, is how much the obsession with Iraq began so early. And what we did in Afghanistan, as he told me, I actually, as you said, I mm-hmm. interviewed him for this piece in the New Yorker the other week. What he said was that we began to draw down our our best warrior groups, our special forces groups, and other sophisticated units, and particularly the special forces people that knew the local language, we began to draw them down by the spring of 2002, 6 months after the, or 4 or 5 months after the actual war began in the fall of 2001, with the idea of building up the Gulf. Guys were taken from Afghanistan and sent to the Gulf for the coming war. And we ended up, instead of being involved in protecting the population across the country, in the, as your correspondent said, in the south and in the east of the country, we ended up running the only operations the American military, the 8,000 or 9,000 guys that had been there more or less consistently, was running operations against Taliban and al-Qaeda, hit-and-run operations. And as usual with the United States, there's a lot of overwhelming force. And one of the things that happened, of course, is that we would attack. Often one warlord would give us intelligence, not necessarily about al-Qaeda, but about against somebody he had a grievance, and we would then attack that person and make more enemies for ourselves. The same pattern you see in Iraq, barging in the homes, roughing up people, bombs, inadvertent deaths, et cetera, et cetera.
Our telephone number, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, email TOTN@npr.org. Bill Westerman in Brookville, Indiana writes, can the territorial power of the warlords in Afghanistan ever be replaced by the central government as long as the warlords have control of the opium production in that country?
The answer is categorically no. And that's as long as. And the UN, just to show you, there's been all this talk about the United States efforts to eradicate crops along with the Brits in Afghanistan. The new UN survey for next year, it's a survey what the farmers plan to plant this year in 2004 for the crop next year. The survey shows a 70% to 75% increase in the amount of acreage being planted in poppies, which is the, you know, the core product of heroin. And so as long as you have the only real cash crop in the country, it's almost a dual economy. There's the you know, billions that are made in illicit growing of poppies for heroin and hashish, and then there's the other commerce which hasn't gone very far. You know, I want to say something about the election. I'm sure it's a serious effort. I'm sure it'd be wonderful if it happened. If it does happen, I can tell you right now, it's a huge priority for this administration for really, I think, very interesting reasons, which is this president knows he's in trouble in Iraq, and this is not only the last few weeks, he's been in trouble for a long time. And the goal was to get something to show that the war on terrorism, the dual invasion of Afghanistan and later Iraq, paid off, that the whole American drive of the notion of creating democracy, this sort of semi-religious cult belief of the people in the White House, and the way they settled on an election in Afghanistan as a must, and it's going to happen. And somebody in the UN process told me that even if we have to just discount some of the areas under the control of certain warlords, we're going to have an election anyway.
And you argue an election before the election in November.
He's got to show that he's paid off with the newly elected president and provincial parliamentary government in Afghanistan. And he can go to the people in October and early November and say, look what we've done. He needs that.
We're speaking with Seymour Hersh of the New Yorker magazine. We're talking about Afghanistan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Fran, who's with us from San Antonio.
Yes, thank you.
Hi.
My question or my thought is, it seems to me that if the warlord's main income and source of power is the benefits from the opium crop, what would be the differential between what we would have to invest to, say, pay the growers of the opium crop to not grow and to allow them to possibly grow food or something else, which would undermine the warlords and the war and benefit the war on drugs, and to help, I'm sure that food isn't of in abundant quantities in Afghanistan. What would it cost us to invest in the purchasing or the amount of money to keep them from growing opium?
Seymour Hersh?
Well, in Plato's cave, in a perfect world, that's a great idea. The reality is, if you invested money in other crops, it would be pretty much hustled away by the warlords. The crops would continue to grow, and you'd simply be putting more money in the wrong people's pockets. That country is a long way away from the idea that you can simply switch them off opium like that. By the way, there was one group that managed to cut back the opium production from 3,600 tons, I think that's the precise number the UN gives, in 2001, it was 180 tons under the Taliban, the same people that we revile so much. One of the things that's so fascinating...
They did other vile things. Let's not forget that.
Oh, my God. Well, that's a given. Yeah. But, you know, it's very interesting. One of the things that's on the table right now is talking to some of the moderate Talibans. It turns out every Taliban wasn't a supporter of Osama bin Laden. They were all very anti-women's rights. They were all very religious fanatics in the sense of a crime is paid for with either a life or a limb. But, you know, things aren't any better now.
Getting back to Fran's question, though, isn't it possible to suppress this crop somehow? I mean, you can identify it. It's not that hard to see.
Well, one of the reasons we've been sort of unsuccessful at it is because it's obviously been a mixed issue for us, because the same warlords who produce most of the opium are also the warlords that are the most willing to nail al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders for us. Much of the production in the South and the East is controlled by people that our armed forces have been dealing with over the last two and a half years in order to get a better jump on where the bad guys are. And that's been the focus. And there is some effort. I will say this. The Pentagon, I must say, there's been a sort of they're much more straightforward, and at least in talking to me about this, they were more openly, more willing to be objective about the failure of their anti-drug program. But they've also decided in the last 3 or 4 or 5 months, obviously under pressure from the civilian bureaucracy and the political leadership in America, to try and get off the warlord business, to try and stop relying so much on warlords to go after al-Qaeda, which meant that we had to look away from the drug dealing. And if we could get the American military and the Brits, our allies, mm-hmm. to really decide to cut off these warlords and go after their crops, which would also mean perhaps a little less efficiency in going after al-Qaeda and Taliban. It's a trade-off that they haven't been willing to make, but that's a factor, too, in the whole issue.
Fran, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We just have a few seconds left with you, Seymour Hersh, but one question you do raise in your piece is that funding reconstruction money from the United States is going at long last into Afghanistan.
It's gone up enormously. It's over $1 billion last year, and it'll be in this year. We've completed a road we wanted to do, and whether or not, the eight people say to me, whether or not it's for politics or for reelection purposes, the fact is it's here now. Let's use it. And schools are being built. Clinics are being built. It doesn't stop the issue of obviate the issue of security. It's still, as your correspondent said, is the biggest issue. But money is flowing, and much more money is coming next year, and that can only be good.
Seymour Hersh, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Seymour Hersh, a correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. His latest piece is entitled The Other War. We're going to continue talking about Afghanistan when we come back from the break. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're catching up with Afghanistan. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now from his office in Boston is Thomas Barfield, a specialist on Afghanistan and a professor of anthropology at Boston University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Is the U.S. military doing enough to help Afghanistan?
Well, it's only doing part of the job because it defines security as chasing Taliban and al-Qaeda, and it's really left the job open for who's to secure security for the Afghans themselves.
Well, in a way, wasn't that supposed to be NATO's job?
Well, it is, but they seem to argue about who's going to supply the equipment, who's going to supply the troops, and who's going to supply the money. And so far, they haven't really ventured outside of Kabul. They certainly have the capacity to do it, and people were hoping that once NATO took charge, that they would prove themselves. But so far, it's been all talk and no action.
An email question about the upcoming elections from Kim Alexander. I'm wondering if you could tell us what kind of voting system is going to be used when elections are held in Afghanistan. Will it be a paper-based voting system, or will the U.S. and its allies recommend paperless electronic voting systems? That seems unlikely in Afghanistan, doesn't it?
I would say very much so, since probably only 10% of Afghanistan has electricity. it will definitely be a paper ballot.
What do Afghans want from these elections, do you think?
The Afghans would like to see this as the first step towards normality. It would really be the first chance since the mid-1960s, really, to elect any leaders at all, and let alone the head of their country. So I think what they're seeing it as is a test to move on to a new political system. I think it's proving that the process can work is probably the most important thing to most Afghans.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Mindy, who's with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
First of all, my compliments to the excellent content of your show
all the time.
And I wanted to make a comment about the last gentleman that was on about the fact that presidential elections that there's always something has to happen when there's an election coming up. And I think that
in our country, Seymour Hersh was talking about, yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think part of the problem with that is that the American population tends to be very impatient. And it's kind of like any CEO of any company has to, by a certain time, prove that they're making a difference in order for them to continue on. And we tend to not be patient here. And I'm not necessarily I'm not going to say whether I'm for or against the agenda as it is, but I think that we have to have something to show in order to continue forward. And we are continuously jumping the gun by not waiting to see what happens and not being patient with what we've established there in Afghanistan, especially. We're 2 years in, and I know that it seems like a long time, but I think we have to give it time. This is a country that has nothing.
Thomas Barfield, do you think we're pressing ahead with elections in Afghanistan before people there are ready?
Probably not necessarily before people are ready, but the people are certainly ready. The question is, can we provide the conditions in which they can vote? The Taliban have threatened to disrupt it. We don't have the registration up and running. And people talked about setting the dates for elections before they talked about how are we going to be able to provide security? So I think it's the people of Afghanistan are certainly ready for elections. The question is, can the international community make them happen?
And do you think, getting back to Mindy's point, that the United States is patient enough to hold the ring until these problems can be worked out?
Well, the United States is notoriously impatient, but I think what the Afghans were concerned about was not so much our impatience as really our switch of attention from Afghanistan to Iraq. And in some senses, they understand American politics a little better than we do, and if it so happens that we've got our eye back on Afghanistan for the American elections, the Afghans understand that and are trying to make every attempt possible to take advantage of that, because while we've been there for 2 years, we don't have a whole lot to be patient about. We have not done what was needed to be done in that country. And therefore, even if it's coming a little bit late and a little bit too fast, what we really need is to get some of the infrastructure projects, Afghans, working, and move away from sort of humanitarian aid focus to infrastructure and self-sustaining economy approaches to Afghanistan.
More projects like that highway that was rebuilt from Kandahar up to Kabul.
But what's even more important is less of a focus on large projects like that than disarming the militias and giving them shovels to fill the potholes. You know, we ran the WPA on the grounds that the more people who have work, the better it is for the political system. And Afghans look upon it the same way. The Afghans have a lot of problems that they could solve themselves. If we would provide the money, hire them, it might not necessarily be up to the same standards as we would expect for our own roads, but we can always come back and build better roads later if the country becomes more stable.
Mindy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We hear a lot, Professor Barfield, about the divisions among Afghans, different ethnic groups, different languages. Is there anything in their history, as you look back, that prepares Afghanistan to be a united country for the future?
Yes, in part because ethnicity in Central Asia and Afghanistan in general is not really of a nationalistic type. If you look at any of these regional leaders of ethnic groups, none of them has ever threatened secession or forming their own independent ethnic republic. The Afghans, as the Afghans see it, they live in a difficult neighborhood, and that's providing a certain amount of unity because they know that they need to hold together just to hold their own in that part of the world. And to some extent, the arguments they have among themselves is in terms of sharing of power, not of sharing different parts of the country. So in some ways, it's an easier thing to work out because they're political compromises that can make it possible. You're not looking at a type of ethnic nationalism that's exclusive, that says it's our way or no way.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Neil, who's with us from Bonn in Germany.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
My comment is that I think we should be concentrating on helping to build democratic governance at the local kind of community level, the tribal level, at the level that Afghanistan's recognized and can work with. And I don't think trying to create some national government out of all these diverse tribes is going to be effective. And that's not really our job. Once some kind of democratic governance is in place at the local and community level, then they can go from there. But otherwise, to try to create some national and big system that they're not used to, it's just going to end in failure. And that's my opinion. And
Professor Barfield?
Well, ironically, the Afghans are probably at their most democratic and organized at the local level. That's one of the reasons they've survived 25 years of war and anarchy. They do know how to run their own areas. But one of the difficulties that they have and where they're looking upon the international community to help them is, how does a local community get rid of a warlord and his militia? How does a local community deal with the outside world? How does a local community deal with Pakistan or Iran? The Afghans understand that government comes at many levels, and they are perfectly capable and probably more competent to run their local affairs than we give them credit for. But what they know and what they've suffered from 25 years is, if you don't have a credible, strong national government, your neighbors take advantage of you, you can't deal with the international community, and how are you to disarm the intermediate groups that currently dominate and exploit local communities that they can't get rid of on their own?
And there's the lurking threat of the kind of civil war that they've seen too often.
They've seen civil war so often, and they hold us partially responsible by ignoring Afghanistan and its problems after the Soviet Union collapsed. They said if the United Nations, if the United States had kept its promises when the Soviets withdrew, that we wouldn't have created the conditions of anarchy that have led to this problem. And they have a strong point, which is why they're somewhat suspicious of the outside world having been abandoned once after many promises.
Neil, thanks for the call.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
We're speaking with Thomas Barfield, a professor of anthropology at Boston University. The subject is Afghanistan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Dave, who's on the line from Nashville, Tennessee.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Afghanistan from 1976 to 78. I can tell you from my experience there that a lot of the tensions that exist are not tensions across ethnic lines in the sense that we see in other places. But there is a tension between the Pashtuns and others. And there is an aspiration among the Pashtuns for a greater Pashtunistan. And there is a history of very, very strong local control and very minimal national control. And there's a lot of bribery and graft and nepotism in terms of who gets what job. And that's how the system has worked there for centuries. And I think we're naive if we expect it to change either overnight or just because there's a national election.
And just a small geography lesson, the Pashtuns, if there's a greater Pashtunistan, it would have to incorporate parts of large parts of western Pakistan. But Professor Barfield, go ahead.
Yes, it is true that one of the big problems is that in the past, the Pashtuns did have a predominant role in the government and working out a more power-sharing relationship with the other ethnic groups is one of the problems that we deal with today. But we also have to remember that because of 20 years of war, the other ethnic groups became empowered and armed and sort of are much more equal politically and militarily. I would disagree a bit that Afghan Pashtuns are as keen on Pashtunistan as they once were. I'm not really sure that the idea of unifying all Pashtuns into a single country has the drawing power that it used to have.
Thanks very much, Dave.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's see if we can talk with Farhad, and Farhad's on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to ask is that why international community? I know the big responsibility is to Afghan people to build their country and national army. I am tired of warlords, absolutely, and so is Afghan people. What I'm asking is that how international community just ignore the fact that Afghanistan definitely needs the security through their forces and go after, like, say, pockets of resistance, which Afghan people can deal with it if they have appropriate resources.
Farhad, are you an Afghan?
I'm an Afghan. I'm from Afghanistan. I've grown up there. I'm 24 years old.
And I guess your question then would be about the requirement for a real national army.
Exactly right.
Thomas Barfield, what are the prospects for that?
It's something that Afghanistan definitely needs, but its training and organization and growth has been disappointingly slow, such that it's in terms of numbers, we're only dealing, you know, with a few thousand troops, and that's far below the 50,000, 100,000 that people were talking about as a coordinated national army. This is one of the reasons that we need the international military forces under NATO playing a bridging role, because one of the most important things that needs to be done is to disarm the regional militias. And at the moment, the Afghan national forces are not really capable of carrying that out. And there has to be a neutral force that if one side disarms, that they know that their rivals won't attack them the next day. And at the moment, the national government can't provide that kind of sort of neutral role. So if we're talking about international forces, it's not to patrol the streets or to keep order. It's essentially to do the heavy work that needs to be done in terms of guaranteeing the disarmament of these regional militias so that we can ratchet down the number of arms and armed men in these areas so that we hopefully wouldn't need as many troops in an Afghan national army to have stability.
Farhad, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
We just have a few seconds left, Professor Barfield, but briefly, what gives you hope? What makes you worry?
What gives me hope is that the Afghans, perhaps because of the experience they've had over the past quarter century, want more than anyone to see this project succeed. While we have groups in Taliban and Hekmatyar's resistance, that by and large what Afghans want is to return their country to some kind of normality. They want an end to guns, an end to violence, and they also are incredibly hard workers in terms of rebuilding their own country. They're not really waiting around for the international community to do the job for them. Over 4 million refugees have returned to Afghanistan largely without aid to rebuild their villages, to rebuild their lives. What gives me the most pause is...
And very quickly, if you would.
...is the fact that the international community has not made the commitment in money or military manpower to bring about a success. They have not really... They know what needs to be done, and yet...
Thomas Barfield at Boston University. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.